You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey, I'm Brian Hyatt, and this is Rolling Stone Music Now. And I couldn't be happier to have with me the absolutely legendary songwriter, Diane Warren, who has her own album, The Cave Sessions Volume 1, coming out in the spring. It's not an album where Diane sings, although she does sing. It's actually an album where she kind of curated other singers to perform. And there's a first single, Times Like This, out that is a really moving song with Darius Rucker singing. But hopefully we'll talk about Diane's entire amazing career. Welcome.
Thank you. Yeah, it's better that other people are singing than me.
Oh, you can sing. I've heard it. We were saying, right now you're in a beautiful part of your studio. There is a sign behind you that says, "Finish my song, bitch." And in fact, at the moment, you are mid-songwriting. You said that you just came from down the street and you have a song in process.
Yeah, it's really good, but I don't like the bridge so far. So I was working on it. I thought this was going to be a phone call, not a video thing. And then it's like, okay, maybe getting away from it for a little while. So maybe you can actually help me. So I appreciate that. You can help me cross that bridge.
We'd be deeply honored. So you literally were working on the bridge when you were yanked away from your piano?
Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, let's hope that is for the song's benefit and you weren't about to have a great breakthrough.
Yeah, you could have really fucked me up and not know. No, I'm just kidding.
Let's talk about, without giving it away so some other songwriter steals the idea and, you know, writes a different version and gets it out before you. But so you're in the middle of this writing this song. How long ago did you start it? When you're struggling with a bridge, does that mean you write multiple ones or that you just hit a wall? Tell me a little bit about it, because it's an interesting opportunity since you're mid-process right now.
Okay, it's a really good song. I'm not going to say the title or anything because, yeah, ideas, you know, I don't want anybody hearing that idea because it's actually a really good idea. And I don't know, I don't even know what I do. I just know that today, I think when I come back to the office, I'm going to get it because the rest of the song's really, really good.
What was the first spark of this song you're working on right now?
Just start playing chords and singing the chorus, basically, you know.
And you work basically every day. I think you once said 12-hour days. Is that still the case?
I mean, I work, yeah, all day long. I work every day. But it's not like 12 hours, you know, continually writing. I mean, I write, you know, and then I might have a meeting. And I mean, back in the day, a million years ago, like a real live meeting before Zoom or a Zoom meeting. It's so weird, like that we don't meet up anymore. I mean, but yeah, that's the new reality. But yeah, so I'll have a meeting or a call, which I prefer the calls because I don't have to put on makeup. Those are a lot easier.
Do you have days when nothing comes, or is it kind of just a rolling flow of music and words out of you that
More that. I mean, I'm just always, you know, I kind of look at it like being an athlete and you always have to practice, you know, so I'm always constantly writing. I'm always kind of constantly, you know, working my writing muscles. So I'm always creating.
Bob Dylan once said that his songwriting is more confessional than professional. Where do you fall on that spectrum, or is that the wrong way to look at it?
I mean, it's the right way for what works for him. I mean, I'm not necessarily confessional because I don't sit and write about myself. You know, that would be really boring. Because, oh, wow, I woke up today and went to work. I mean, not a really exciting, you know, concept for a song. You know, so I have a really good imagination and I kind of just utilize that.
Have you ever in your life had any kind of extended period of anything like writer's block?
Not for extended periods. I get stuck on stuff.
If you have a bridge that isn't working, a specific part of the song, does that mean you write multiple stabs at it and then pick the best one, or how does that work?
Well, it's kind of figuring out with anything. It's you figure out what doesn't work to find what does work. If we're talking about this song in particular, I've tried a couple things I'm not happy with yet, but that just got those out of the way so I can find the right. It's kind of like finding someone to fall in love with. You get rid of all the people that didn't work so you can find the right one. I don't know if that was a good metaphor, but
I don't know how much of this is still valid, but I I've heard that you work in very specific ways. You use kind of, you, at least you used to use kind of the same cassette setup, the same kind of stuff. Did you stick with that method?
Yeah. I still have a Walkman. I use cassettes. I think it's kind of cool all of a sudden. So, you know, I just do what I've always done. You know, I just do what I've always done since I started doing this.
Do you still have a little bit of a superstition of changing the methods that, and changing your office and all that?
I don't know if it's that as much as laziness at this point.
Well, take us through. I mean, it's usually it's the piano
or guitar
and the cassette, and then I think you have people who work for you who will work up an arrangement based on your simple arrangement. Is that kind of how it works?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I have producers I work with that can take the song to the next level production wise. You know, I'm not a producer. You know, I'd rather go to the next song than, you know, come up with the right, you know, drum pattern or arrangement or, you know, so I'd rather leave that to other people that are better at that than me. So, yeah.
It's really interesting because there's other hit songwriters, people like Max Martin and stuff, who have the song and the arrangement and the production much more tightly integrated.
Right. I mean, I kind of arrange it in my head. There's certain things that I'll hear in a song when I'm writing it. You know, I'm just not a programmer and all that. That's not what I do. But there's definitely things I hear. But you know, someone like Max is more of a producer, writer. I'm just a writer. I'm old school. I'm a songwriter.
Exactly. The way you work is the way they worked in the Brill Building.
Yeah, I feel like I continue that on in some kind of way.
Now, what gave you the idea to do an album and to do it this way with a sort of a curated batch of singers? It's almost like you're a DJ like Calvin Harris or something.
Yeah, I'm DJ Diane. That's what I keep telling people. I just thought it was a cool idea. You know, it started from, I mean, I've seen, you know, Mark Ronson, people like that, and DJ Khaled or Calvin Harris. You know, they're usually DJ producers. And I thought, you know, I haven't really seen a songwriter do that. And then I have this song, you know, I kind of have to thank John Legend for this because I did a song with him and he loved the song, was going to put on his album, then he didn't. And so I gave it to another artist. And I told John, I go, he goes, no, get it back, I want it. And then he didn't use it again. And then I gave it to another artist, and the same thing that I ran into John. He goes, no, I want it. And by the way, two of those artists are on my album, and I'm not going to say who yet. But I had to pull it from, you know, two artists, and then he didn't do it again. And the song, it's so great. It's one of my best songs I ever wrote. And his performance is phenomenal. And so that kind of, I thought, you know what, I have to do this record, and I have to have that song on this record. The world needs to hear it. And I start thinking of other artists I want to work with, and I mean, I did a song, you know, with Ty Dolla $ign. That's amazing. And I did something with Celine Dion. I did some, you know, there's so many cool, Jhené Aiko is on it. And then the crazy thing, it's actually a good problem. You know, this is volume one. I have almost too many songs. I mean, like, because I keep writing new songs. I go, well, I want to do this with this person. I want to do that with that person. So it keeps, you know, changing. There's probably a core six or seven songs I know are on this, but other ones keep, you know. But there'll be volume two, and then there'll be deluxe and all that.
I feel like, and it's hard to generalize because you write so many songs, but there's been a bit of a turn to the topical in recent years, and I think times like this is an example of that.
Some man with a sign saying I need money for beer. So I reached in my pocket and I said I got some right here.
I wonder if you could just kind of break down how you wrote that song.
With times like this, you know, it was like maybe two, you know, maybe a month or month into the pandemic, I think it was a month or two, and I just started writing that chorus, and I loved it. It felt so anthemic and hopeful. And I kept hearing in my head, I kept hearing Darius Rucker's voice, because his voice, you know, I always say it's like comfort food. You know, he's like listening to a friend. So when we're going through all this turmoil and this pandemic and everything being shut down, here's a voice, you know, in my head I was hearing it anyways. But I didn't know Darius. And so through a friend of mine, I got his manager's number and called him. And I wrote the song. And the funny thing, there's a line in the song, saw a man with a sign saying, I need money for beer, right? And like a few years ago, I was in Nashville, and I did see someone holding a sign saying, I'm not going to lie, I need beer. You know, I need a beer. I'm like, you know, I thought, you know, mental note to myself, that's going to find its way into a song, and it did. And it was, and then Darius loved it, and he recorded it, and I'm really proud of the song. And I love the video, too.
It's a great video. How long, a song like that, how long did it take you to write?
I mean, I usually spend a week on a song because lyrics take me the longest time. It's hard to break down exactly how long it took, but I really put a lot. I mean, I always put a lot into my songs. They have to be really right.
And if you're spending a week on that song, are there other songs you're working on that same week, or do you kind of?
No, I can't do that. It's schizophrenic. Uh-huh. Yeah, I like to work on one song at a time.
And do you always finish them and then move on, or do you have a stack of half-finished stuff that someday you'll return to?
I don't do anything half-finished. I try to finish everything I start, you know. I don't want to get into it unless I love it, because I know it's going to take time.
Our house is a mess. Come on in. I'm Amber Wallen, internet comedian and host of your new favorite podcast, Fly on the Wallen.
Okay, that's pretty presumptuous to assume that this is going to be their favorite podcast, by the way.
Anyway, that wasp that you just heard interrupt me is my husband.
And co-host, Benjamin Wallen.
Listen in as we discuss relationships and keeping our sweet baby kid alive.
Fly on the Wallen, wherever you listen.
America starts the day with America in the Morning.
First of three pushes of storminess.
Hi, I'm John Trout, your host for the latest news, politics, entertainment, business, and weather.
A speech with political overtones.
Our staff of correspondents provide a fast-paced look at the world with specialized reports from where news happens.
Judge's decision was based on finding there is a likelihood.
So far, the central bank appears to be threading that.
Concise, accurate, and fresh each day.
America in the Morning, the podcast, available wherever you listen.
I wanted to go through some of your songs, if that's okay with you.
Sure.
We did this with Smokey Robinson recently, and so it's always fun to look back.
I love him. Oh, my God. He's so great.
Oh, he's incredible. I believe that your first real hit was that song Solitaire.
I just wrote lyrics to that, so I don't consider that my first hit. I think my first real hit.
Okay, so it's Rhythm of the Night then.
Yeah, that was the first song that I wrote words and music to, and that, you know, was a big hit.
It's time to get out, step out into the street, where all of the action is right there at your feet. Well,
that's a song I remember very well from when I was a kid. It was incredibly ubiquitous. It's a great song. I was just listening back to it yesterday. And it does loom very large in your catalog. Tell me about how that came together, what you remember of it.
I mean, I can't remember what I did last week, so... so it's hard to exactly. I mean, I wrote it for a movie called The Last Dragon, and I think I had just gotten a Linn drum machine, as I recall. Remember Linn drum machines?
Oh, yeah.
So I'd just gotten that. I think that was probably one of the first songs I wrote with that, you know, using that. And DeBarge ended up doing it, and yeah.
And I was also going to ask you about, I know you grew up hearing show tunes and
Beatles.
And the Beatles. And do you remember the spark?
Wait, I just did a song that has two Beatles on it. How cool is that? Ringo's new single.
Yes.
Oh, sorry.
Yes, I was going to get that.
Jumped the gun on that.
That's a pretty big full circle thing, though, for you, isn't it?
Oh, my God. Like I'm still pinching myself. I mean, I was that kid. I have older sisters, so, you know, one of my sisters took me to see the Beatles twice, you know, and I was the biggest Beatle fan, you know, in the world. And, you know, the fact that there's Ringo and Paul are singing on my song is, you know, along with some other great people. But that's a pinch myself moment, to be sure.
Yeah, Here's to the Nights is that song.
I'm excited about that song. And people really love it. So.
Here's to right now, right here. Here's to the nights we won't remember.
How did that get in Ringo's hands? Did he reach out to you for a song and you had that? Or you wrote that thinking of him? Or how did that work?
Well, I had done a song with him years ago called In a Heartbeat, you know, and that was like Ringo with Brian Wilson, so that was pretty cool, too, a long time ago. I mean, that was like, I don't know, 20-something years ago, and he asked me for a song, and I had Here's to the Nights. No one had ever done it. I mean, I probably wrote it a couple of years ago, and so I was thinking, I had the whole concept in my mind, because it's almost like, you know, Here's to the Nights we won't remember, with the friends we won't forget. It's almost like the follow-up to With a Little Help from My Friends. Right. And I was thinking, and my whole ulterior motive, I have to be honest, because I said, Ringo, let's get some of your old friends. Let's get some new friends. And, you know, my whole thing is like Paul McCartney. And And Ringo asked Paul, and he said he was the first person to say yes. And then, you know, Dave Grohl and Sheryl Crow and Chris Stapleton, Lenny Kravitz, Joe Walsh, you know, all kinds of really cool people are on the song, too. So it's kind of, and I love that video, too.
It has a sort of like a beer mug swinging in the air kind of groove
to it. Yeah, it's like
it.
An Irish pub song, isn't
yes,
it, really?
Exactly.
I just think it's going to be one of those songs that can be a New Year's anthem or a graduation anthem or any, and especially now, like, none of us can be with our friends, right? You know, except on a Zoom call, which isn't quite the same, you know. So here's a song about celebrating friendship and memories and new memories to come.
Well, that was one of the things I thought about hearing that is, geez, I don't know if I heard a Diane Warren song with this particular vibe.
Yeah, it's different for me. I love it. But I have all kinds of songs that, you know, there's all kinds of sides to what I do. I'm pretty excited about that one.
But yeah, going back to, so it was the Beatles, show tunes. What was the spark of I Want to Be a Songwriter?
I remember looking on a single, and it was up on the roof, said Goffin King. I remember wanting to be in the parentheses. Kids back when there were singles. They were called singles. They were called 45s. I always loved music, you know? So when I was about 8 or 9, I just felt like I was going to be a songwriter. I talked my dad into getting me a little guitar from Tijuana. And, you know, I just started making up songs. But when I was about 14, I became pretty obsessed with it, which is exactly how I am now. Like, I'm no different than I was. Like, I'm still obsessed with doing this. And, you know, I feel like I haven't done my best work yet. I'm always getting better. So it's exciting. I love it.
I think your dad, like, got you a subscription to Billboard around that time. And so you were focused on, like, you were kind of willing yourself into those charts. You were focused on
Oh yeah, and I studied who wrote every song. I was like, that was school for me. I mean, I kept getting kicked out of schools because I hated school and stuff. But once I, you know, found what I love, and Billboard was kind of like going to school because I really would research everything and because I cared about that.
It's fascinating, and I love the idea that you wanted to be in those parentheses. You didn't want to be on TV, you didn't want to be on stage, you wanted to be in those parentheses.
I have stage fright. Yeah, I'm cool in the parentheses.
That's so awesome. And was there ever a point where you were thinking, hey, I should be a performer too?
Not one second.
Now, you know, you very smartly went on to start your own publishing company, you have your own company, you're completely self-sufficient. But what were your steps into the business? Like, how did you get from the 14-year-old obsessed with it to the point where you can get a song to DeBarge?
I mean, it just took time. I mean, I was signed to a guy named Jack White, not White Stripes Jack White, a German producer that produced Laura Branigan. And through that, that's how, that was my first publishing deal. But, you know, I knocked on a lot of doors for a lot of years. And the way I started my company, you know, it wasn't because I was a savvy business person. It was basically because I was in a lawsuit with him, with that publisher after a while. And it had been right after, I think, Rhythm of the Night, so everybody kind of wanted to sign me, and I couldn't sign anywhere. My lawyer was like, you know, you need to start your own publishing company. I go, but I don't want to. You know, and I kind of had to, and so I came up with Real Songs, because that's what I think I write, Real Songs. And then all of a sudden, all these hits started happening, and they were songs I owned, and I never looked back. And so it wasn't because I was super savvy or anything, it just happened. You know, now, you know, my company, you know, I have one writer, and it's a pretty successful company, so.
Yeah, it's wild. That's the best advice anyone could have ever possibly gotten is start your own publishing company in your case.
Great advice.
It's incredible. I was thinking, there's Hypnosis and other companies that are going so hard at people to get their publishing. Have they approached you?
I know Merck. You know, I'm friends with Merck. Yeah. You know, he knows that is, you know, a non-starter. It would be like selling my soul, and that's not for sale. You know, these songs are like my kids. I mean, I know a lot of people are doing it, and I get it. You know, I mean, times are hard, and if you need the money, and you know, with publishing being so valuable, I mean, it's true, you know, it's truly one of the most valuable assets, I guess, in the world. It's a great song. But yeah, I'm not interested in selling. No.
Yeah. So on some level, you understand why some people are doing it. It's just not.
Yeah, I mean, I get it. Especially if someone's really struggling or maybe, I don't, you know, everybody has their reasons. I can only, you know, speak for myself, and that would be never anything I'd do, because that's a part of me. That's like my soul.
You've gone through and transcended so many eras in popular music not so many eras, you know, not hundreds of years, but you know, it's time in pop music moves faster than in real time. Has there ever been a time where...
It always comes down to a great song, though. I mean, the thing that's the one thing that'll always be a common denominator. A great song will always, you know, work. It might be how you arrange it, or you might, you know, you have to be, you know, malleable and you have to be current. You know, so I'm always, you know, listening to what's going on and being influenced by all kinds of stuff.
Has anything radically shifted the way you write or made you attempt something radically different as you hear these changes in the way? Because, I mean, there's, you know, one of the things is that there's tons of songs that are huge hits that aren't even linear songs. There's some songs that are the kind of songs that can be performed on with piano and voice the way it's always been. But there's also a large number of songs that are
production
sort of fractured bits that are just, just a totally different thing.
That's not really what I do, you know, and that's kind of a production thing. And there's something cool to that, too. But, you know, I kind of believe that if it doesn't sound good on my guitar when I'm playing it or my piano, it's not a good song. It's got to stand there for me.
With Rhythm of the Night, what did your demo sound like? Do you remember?
I remember there was a wrong note on it. And sometimes when I hear that record, I think it's going to hit the wrong note. Isn't that weird? like on that demo, something, that's what I remember. But it was a cool demo. The demo sounded, you know, a lot like the record. The arrangement was there.
And what was it like when your dream came true, basically, and you were hearing, that was the first song. I mean, again, that song was everywhere. And there you were with your first hit.
It was everywhere to the fact that, it was amazing, of course. Anytime I hear my song on the radio, I love it. I remember going to Russia in 1989, and there was a translator. A bunch of songwriters went there to write with Russian songwriters. And the translator asked me what songs I'd written, and I started singing, you know, the chorus of Rhythm of the Night, and the guy goes, he didn't speak English, and he went, DeBarge. And that was in Russia before, you know, the fall of communism. So that song got through before, you know, everything. So that was just a cool moment. So to realize that, you know, you can't keep a good song down.
Incredible. I won't go in chronological order. I'll just go through some songs. I know that you said a title can be a real starting point for you. A title can be really important. Was Unbreak My Heart, which is, you know, definitely one of the best song titles of all time, of course, famously recorded by Tony Braxton. Was that an example of title first writing?
Yeah, I had that. I came up with that title, and I started playing the chorus, you know, with those chords.
Unbreak my heart, say you love me again.
Yeah, it's a weird title, right? Like created a word, you know.
It's interesting because I think that song starts out with a pain rain rhyme.
I remember Clive Davis, when I played that song, goes, you can't rhyme rain and pain. He wanted me to change it. And I go, no, it works.
That's what I was going to say. It's like everyone knows that that's a bit of a cliche, but that's the easy thing is to be like, oh, that's a cliche.
But I like in all this pain and out in the rain. That's what made it cool. Don't you know?
I think the true genius is to know when you keep that in the song. That's what you knew. You knew it worked.
Exactly.
And then, you know, the other thing is you must have been very pleased when you then got to Uncry These Tears, because that takes it, as lyrically, that takes it to the next level. And that's the kind of thing that's where some genius comes in.
I don't know. It just was the logical place to go. But thank you.
And again, I mean, you know, was Tony Braxton, did you picture anyone in particular singing that when you wrote it?
I mean, I went to play the song for Clive. I thought it could be a good song for her, and he loved it for her. And she didn't really like it, but she recorded it anyways, yeah.
Is that true?
That's what I heard. It happens.
I imagine she has since changed her mind.
I hope so. Maybe she hates it more. She's had to sing it the last 20 years, so.
And this is a song that, you know, I think it's definitely one of the most moving songs I've heard by you, and it's Because You Love Me, of course, Celine Dion. And I think I heard somewhere that it's a little bit about your dad.
Well, I wrote it for the movie Up Close and Personal, but I tapped into like thanking my dad for believing in me, because he always really believed in my music and you know, was always supportive. So that was a way to...
Yes, I remember that movie well as Robert Redford and I think Michelle Pfeiffer.
It'd be kind of like a Me Too thing now, wouldn't it? I mean, could they make that movie now?
That's right. It's literally about... I think he was like her boss.
I mean, you know, I loved that movie though. But yeah, right? Uh-oh, it was like Me Too.
Back then, they were, and now that they sit down and screen you the movie, and then you sit down and write, or is that how that would work?
Yeah, that movie, I remember the director showing it to me.
I actually remember seeing that movie in the theater in the moment that that your song came up. The other thing that's great is that movie was co-written by Joan Didion. So a lot of great talent on that movie.
Yeah,
that's actually wild.
Robert Redford. That was a great movie, actually.
I guess that's the closest to a Joan Didion collaboration you've had. That's incredible.
I think so. She's amazing.
Another incredible song, How Do I Live, for Leanne Rimes. What do you remember about that one?
I remember getting in a lot of trouble because there was two versions of it. I wrote the song for the movie Con Air.
You got in trouble because there's also the Trisha Yearwood version.
Well, yeah. Well, what happened was, so I wrote it, and I wrote it for the movie, and I played it for Jerry Bruckheimer, and he liked it. But there was, I think, 200 other songs, you know, in the mix at the time for that movie. And I happened to run into Leanne Rimes at a restaurant, and I told her I wrote the song for it. Do you want to demo it? And Leanne had just won, you know, the Grammy for Best New Artist. She was kind of the hot new artist. And so she came in and demoed it. And remember I said I wrote it for, remember, they didn't know that it wasn't picked yet. So she went back and recorded it, you know, did a video and spent all this money. And I played it for Jerry. And he was excited about Leanne, but he wanted some changes made. And her dad, who was a co-producer on the song, wouldn't. He was like, "I'm not changing nothing for them Hollywood people." I was like, "Wilbur, her dad's Wilbur." I go, "Wilbur, just it's okay. Just change it for the movie. You have your record. Your record's great." But he wouldn't do it. And then Jerry asked if it was okay to put Trisha on. And I said, "Yeah, but I can't pull it from Leanne, even if Trisha does it for the movie." And then Jerry was like, "No, you have to pull it from Leanne." And I couldn't do that. And then Leanne was mad at me, and Jerry was mad at me, and until it became, you know, the big. I mean, Leanne's version is still the biggest hit, the number one song by a female artist in Billboard to this day, of all the years in Billboard. So then they all started liking me again, and Jerry was like, "I'm never going to work with you again." And then the next year, I did "I Don't Want to Miss a Thing" for Armageddon, so he did work with me again. But it was like there was a time when everybody was really kind of hating me, and then they liked me again. That's what hits do. They make people like you, even after they hate you. Yeah, and Trisha won a Grammy for that, too, so.
Well, there must be a lot of people who like you then. I don't know if it may be the single most uncharacteristic song, but you have a writing credit on the song "You Make Me Rock Hard."
That was my title, too. Kiss. Yeah.
I think Desmond Child and Paul Stanley
wrote
with
Paul
you. How did that come about, and how did you dare to come up with that title?
I thought it was a really good title for a Kiss song. And, you know, I thought it was kind of funny. And then, you know, Paul loved it, and we ended up writing the song. And I've done other songs for Kiss. I think I did the only song that they didn't write, or one of them, was called "Nothing Can Keep Me From You" from Detroit Rock City. Wow. So it's kind of cool to, you know, you make me rock hard. Can't believe I came up with that title, but yeah.
Did you think of it for Kiss?
Yeah. I was working with Paul at the time and stuff, and Desmond, and I said, let's do a song where you make me rock hard.
Did they laugh?
I can't remember. Remember, I can't remember what I did last week. So, I mean, they probably did. Like, how do you not laugh at that?
Well, the fact that you wrote the Star Is Born instant classic, "Why Did You Do That?" "Why'd You Come Around Me with an Ass Like That?" tends to make.
And that's my line. By the way, all these lines that you wouldn't think are me are my lines. Like, that was my line. I go, "Is it okay if we say that to Gaga?" And she goes, yeah, that's fine. And then and I didn't see the song in the movie till the premiere, and then that's the one that Bradley Cooper is like, you know, right, basically saying she's a terrible artist for saying a line like that. I'm like, oh, cool, that's my line.
Well, it just, once you realize that you came up with You Make Me Rock Hard, it all starts to make sense. There's the whole other lyrical side of
oh, yeah, I have a whole other side that no one even knows of yet. Like, you know.
Clearly.
Yeah.
Clearly. that's amazing. I wanted to ask you about a song that, objectively speaking, is a great song, and yet has an inevitable degree of infamy attached to it, which is Blame It on the Rain.
Oh, I love that song. Thank you.
Great song. It happens to have been recorded by Milli Vanilli, or attributed to Milli Vanilli, which again lends it that degree of infamy. But tell me about writing it, and tell me about that whole, like, who did you think was recording it? Were you told that these dudes, how did all that work out?
First of all, when I wrote the song, there was a group at the time called The Jets, and they had kept it on hold for a year. They were supposed to record it, and then they didn't. And I was like really kind of pissed off because I sat on the song. And I went to see Clive again, in New York, and I knew that was a hit song. And it's kind of a funny little story. When I was writing it, I was really bored writing the verse, and my hand slipped, and it goes up a half step in the middle of the verse in a really weird place, but it really works. Anyways, but I went to see Clive, and he played, like, before I even played the song, he goes, I have this new group, Milli Vanilli, and he played Girl, You Know It's True. And it's almost like the same rhythm, Girl, You Know It's True, Blame It on the Rain, kind of weird. And I go, oh my God, this is so weird, because I came to play you this song, and I had no idea who it's for. And I think it's the follow-up to that. And Clive loved the song, and they recorded it. Whoever recorded it. but whoever sang it, I love it. I love that song. And I had no idea. I don't think anybody did until, I guess, they were singing live, and it stopped on Girl, You Know It's, Girl, You Know It's, Girl, You Know It's. I mean, oops.
Do you think Clive knew?
I have no idea. I don't think Clive knew. You know, I think that was maybe more common with some of the European groups. I think when you win Best New Artist, though, it probably helps to sing.
Does that put any mark on this song for you? Does it make it funny for you? Or how do you kind of see that?
No. I'm proud of that song. I love that song. I think that whole album was great. You know, I mean, it's nothing to do with the work I did. You know, I wrote a great song, and that Milli Vanilli album's classic. And I hope everybody that sang on there was compensated, that being said.
Yeah, seriously. It was interesting to, you know, I listened to it on headphones last night, and I don't know if I'd ever listened to that song on headphones, because it's one of those, you know, radio songs, and it's just, you know, this is great. Everything about this is great, from the songwriting to the production, vocals great. It just happens to have not been by those two guys.
Yeah. yeah, little problem there, but yeah.
Another song that was just everywhere was, and I think it was a co-write, but Don't Turn Around by Ace of Base.
Yeah, I wrote that with Albert Hammond, and that started out as a B-side on a Tina Turner record.
Did she actually record it? It was a B-side?
Yeah, it was, it's kind of a funny story. That's when Tina had her big, you know, What's Love Got to Do With This, was for the follow-up album, and she did record it, and Brian Adams produced it. And then I remember them telling me it wasn't going to be on the album, and I was pretty bummed, and then it was the B-side of Typical Male, and somehow Luther Ingram, who did If Loving You Is Wrong, I Don't Want to Be Right, somehow he, you know, turned that single over, back when they were singles, kids, and heard the song, and it became, you know, not a big R&B hit, but, you know, I don't know how big it was. Not big. And somehow someone from a group called Aswad, an English reggae group, heard that and did it reggae.
Right.
And it became massive all over the world, basically, except here, because I always kind of, my theory was a group called Aswad might need to change its name. I don't know. but they did a couple of my songs.
It's A-S-W-A-D, yeah, for the listener. But yes, it's too close. Yeah.
But I don't know. It was it was a great record. And other people recorded it along the way, like Neil Diamond did a version of it, Bonnie Tyler. It got done by a lot of people. And again, Clive, he heard the Aswad version and gave it to Ace of Base. And their record's cool. They kind of went, you know, to a minor key in the chorus, and it was really fresh. I loved what they did.
You wrote a few songs with Albert Hammond. I think you wrote
Nothing's Gonna Stop Us Now. We did.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
What is he like? Because a lot of people know his son. he is, for the record, the father of Albert Hammond Jr. from the Strokes.
Yeah, and I remember Albert Hammond Jr. in the room when we were writing, and he was a little kid, and yeah, it's just odd. No, Albert's great, you know, it's great. We did some really good stuff together, and he's a good friend of mine. I love him.
Basically a member of the Strokes was sitting there running around while you were writing songs for Jefferson Airplane.
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Starship, I remember the Strokes as a child was running around while we were writing a song from a movie about a guy fucking a mannequin. Yes.
Sounds about right.
Was that child abuse? Just kidding.
He grew up to be in the Strokes. He's doing fine. One of my favorites, I Don't Want to Miss a Thing.
I could stay awake just to hear you breathing. Watch you smile while you...
That's such a great song. How do you write a song like that? Where does that come from?
I mean, again, it was a title I had, and I saw the end of the movie. I met with Jerry Bruckheimer. Remember, he said he wasn't going to work with me ever again a year before? So he changed his mind.
So he actually showed you like the... It's Armageddon, right? He showed you the end of... He showed you just the end of Armageddon and said, here...
Yeah, and told me the story of it. But it was a scene. I knew it was going to be like when they're wedding. And, he kind of walked me through it. And, I went back and wrote the song. And never in a million years thought Aerosmith would do it. But they did. So that was pretty cool. I mean, it's still cool. Because you know what? Like, I kind of thought a female vocalist would end up doing it, but it's so much more powerful, especially like Steven Tyler, that rock kind of thing, being that vulnerable in a song, really worked.
Now, I assume a lot of the dramatic octave jumping and stuff, that was purely his arrangement of it. That wasn't built into the...
The ending and stuff, you mean?
Yeah.
That was Steven,
Yeah.
Being Steven and doing... the cool shit like only he can do.
That must have been, I'm sure it's always interesting to, and sometimes maybe appalling to hear what people do with the songs. That must have been a particularly interesting case of kind of putting some rocket fuel into what was a piano and voice demo.
Oh, I mean, I remember the first time hearing it and just being literally, knocked off my chair of how great that was, because I wasn't in the studio or anything. And so I didn't hear, in that beautiful, great intro with the strings, and just it's just a great... that should have won Record of the Year. That was a great record. Matt Serletic produced that.
It's incredible. And another great one, If I Could Turn Back Time by Cher. Great video too. It had nothing to do with
by
that.
By the way, but she still fits into that outfit. She does. She does. Don't you hate her? Just kidding.
It doesn't surprise me one bit.
She's awesome.
Tell me about that one.
It was a song I thought was a great song for her, and she hated it. And so I went to the studio when she was recording another song of mine. And literally, when she was in the lounge, got on my hands and knees and held her leg down until she said she'd try it out. She goes, I hate that fucking song. I hate it. I go, well, I'm not letting your leg go until you tell me that... I go, look, I'll pay for the track. She goes, okay. I go, I'll pay for it. If it doesn't work, then it's all my cost, but I know the song's right for you. She goes, I hate it, but I'll do it. I'll try it, And then, the rest is... That's probably her most iconic song, so that worked out
incredible.
Too.
Incredible. And then when it gets to the point when you see the video with the assless chaps or whatever, do you just laugh to yourself knowing that it almost didn't even exist?
Yeah, I mean, in in that video, I remember that's how long ago it was. They couldn't play that till after midnight because it was so risque. What? Really? Well, when she's on that Canon, I guess it's a little phallic, but that's nothing, compared to, now.
People do not find Michael Bolton cool, but you wrote some great songs for him.
I think Michael Bolton's cool. He's a great singer.
He is a great singer.
I've never been cool either. What does cool mean?
It's cool is overrated. But you wrote that song, How Can We Be Lovers, and that's just an undeniable song.
Yeah, that's a fun song. But my favorite song was a song I wrote for him called When I'm Back on My Feet Again. That's still one of my favorite songs I've ever written. And the great thing about Michael is we would write songs together, but then again, if I gave him a song like that, or when I wrote Time, Love, and Tenderness, which is a big hit for him too, that I wrote, that he was open. He was open to doing it, which is a great quality, I thought, because he didn't really need to do that. But if you heard a song that was right that he didn't write.
You and Albert Hammond, again, I believe, wrote a song that people might have forgotten about, which is actually a duet between Aretha Franklin and Whitney Houston. It isn't, it wasn't, it ain't never going to be. Did you get to be around for the recording of that by any chance?
No, I wasn't there. But it was pretty cool to have those two artists on that song. Wasn't that big of a hit at the time, but I still was proud of it.
That must have been a hell of a day in the studio, whoever got to be there.
Yeah, I wish I was there.
And you, speaking of collaborations, you wrote that the Gloria Estefan and NSYNC collaboration, Music of My Heart.
Yeah, I love that song. Yeah, that was one of my... one of my 11 Oscar nominations that I lost. but I love that. It was a good movie too. And I remember the movie had a different title, then they changed the the movie title to the name of that song.
Now, are there songs, you've written a tremendous number of songs. Are there songs that you've written that you've almost completely forgotten that you couldn't sing the chorus of by this point?
Yeah, you have no idea. Like, so many. And so many are really good. And I'll all of a sudden think about it, like, you know, songs I haven't even demoed yet that are there. I'm like, God, this is a great song, you know. So then it's like sometimes, like for Ringo as an example, like Here's the Nights is a great song that I kind of forgot about. And then when he asked me for a song, it was like, oh my God. And so sometimes it takes that, you know, someone, you know, asking for a song. But I need to, yeah, I probably need to go demo some of these things. And cause there's some great songs in there. Because I'm always writing new ones.
Well, how do you avoid repeating yourself, whether lyrically or musically or both? Or accidentally plagiarizing yourself?
I know, I rip myself off and then I have to sue myself, so, you know. you know, I try not to, but of course there's times, you know, I'll write something that sounds a little bit like something else I did, and I don't know.
And we're all actually almost out of time, incredibly, but I wanted to ask you about writing I Was Here for Beyonce, and I think you also were in the studio possibly with her.
I was, and that's one of the best experiences ever, you know, for me. So when I wrote I Was Here, I wrote on my guitar because a friend of mine was 3 hours late, and I had my acoustic guitar there. And I was thinking, like, I was just, you know, I started, you know, with the line, I want to leave my footprints on the sands of time. I was like, ooh, that's really a good line. And I just, that song kind of just started writing itself. And I thought, this could be a really great song for Beyonce, and it could also be like a song for like Leona Lewis, who was really big at the time, you know, or Susan Boyle, both Simon Cowell's artists. So, you know, I did a little acoustic guitar version of it. I sent it to Simon, and then I called Jay-Z, and he called me back, and I played it on the guitar. I thought, you know, I thought this could be great for Beyonce. It's different for her, and he loved it. He said, "Stay by your phone. She's going to land, you know, as soon as she lands, she's calling you." She did. I played her the song. She goes, "Okay, this is Monday. Her album was supposed to come out Friday." She said, "I'm going in Wednesday and I'm recording that song. I'm stopping my album." So I went in the studio with her and blown away by that vocal. And that was, then she goes, "Well, let's take a dinner break now and then I'm going to go back and do it again." I'm like, "What? What do you mean do it again? Like, it's perfect." She goes, "No, I'm going to get it better." And that's the difference, by the way, between a great artist and not a great artist. Right? I mean, that's why she's going to be around forever. And so anyways, the funny part of the story. So I couldn't even sleep all night because I was so excited about how that song was coming out. I wake up in the morning. Remember, I'd given it to Simon Cowell. I had an email from his head of A&R going, you know, the song, it's nice, but it just doesn't go all the way for us. You know, feel free to send more stuff. And so my email back was, funny enough, I was in the studio last night with probably the biggest artist on the planet. And funny enough, it went all the way for her. Smiley face. So that was a fun email to write right after, I mean, the morning after being up all night with that, getting a rejection letter. So that was for I Was Here.
I guess actually we're out of time, but Diane Warren, thank you so much for joining me. I feel like we could have, we could do this all day. It was so fun.
I know, for me too, so.
Thanks again, and we're looking forward to the album in the spring.
Yeah, or summer, or whenever.
Or summer.
Because it keeps changing. I mean, every minute it changes in a good way. So thank you.
It's that kind of year. And that is our show for today. Happy New Year. Thanks again to Diane Warren. And we'll be back next week here on SiriusXM's Volume, Channel 106. In the meantime, we are, of course, a podcast. Download us as a podcast. Subscribe to us as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Maybe leave us a nice review on iTunes if you can. As always, thanks for listening. Stay safe. It's a crazy world out there, and we will see you next week.